Well, recently we've seen a number of high-profile leaders in the evangelical world who have had very public falls, and it seems to be happening more and more frequently these days. The question is, why does it happen, and what can be done to avoid it? Well, that's what we're talking about today on Daniel Kalenda Off the Record. Right off the bat, I want to mention that I've got a couple of really interesting podcast channels that I'm going to be releasing this year, four of them to be exact, including one that will deal with all kinds of things relating to evangelism, another one that will be sermons and preaching content, and one that I'm really excited about in which I'm going to go through the Bible verse by verse. My dream is actually to provide a commentary on every verse in the Bible before I die. Also, on this podcast, Off the Record, I've got several shows in the pipeline for you that touch on some really interesting and provocative stuff. I'm going to be answering questions that have come in from some of our listeners. And against my better judgment, I'll be diving into some controversial topics. So that should be interesting. So don't forget to like, subscribe, hit that notification bell, or otherwise follow this podcast on whatever platform is best for you. The content is available on all social media and podcast platforms, and it's always absolutely free. However, if you would like to help support me, you can do so through my Patreon account. It's patreon.com/Daniel Kalenda. Again, that's patreon.com/DanielKolenda. There's also a link in the description. And speaking of questions from our listeners, if you have a question that you would like me to address on this podcast, you can send it to questions@askdk.com, where I'm watching all of the messages that come in closely, as well as my team, and we are curating a list of questions that I'll be taking the time to address on this podcast. Well, this is the first off-the-record podcast of 2021. I know that many of us are glad to be looking at 2020 in the rearview mirror. It was a strange year for many reasons. You know all the obvious ones, but I can't help but think that despite all of the chaos and tragedy and uncertainty, there must have been some silver lining along the way. You know, in nature, great upheaval is often good for a system as a whole in the long run. For example, a forest fire is devastating, but it provides an indispensable service to the forest. It clears out a lot of the weak and sick growth. It breaks down a lot of the dead things that were keeping sunlight from reaching the floor of the forest. It makes way for new life and new growth. There's even certain pine cones, I think they're called serotonous cones, that hold their seeds sometimes for years until a fire comes through and melts the resin around the cone and allows it to open so that it can release its seeds. And I feel like we're going to discover as we go that similar things have happened in 2020. And in fact, throughout every season of upheaval and difficulty in life, that often those fires help to clean the forest floor, so to speak. And they prepare us for greater fruitfulness and growth in the days ahead. This is what botanists are doing when they prune a plant, too. They're cutting away what is weak and dying and dead in order to redirect the resources and energy of the plant into something that can be more fruitful. And I pray that one day, hopefully soon, you'll look back at 2020 and actually thank God for it. I think there's also been some hidden blessings that we might not even be aware of yet, because we often don't recognize good things while they're happening. For example, I had so much more time with my family this year than I've ever had. Now, I still did a lot of traveling and I was still extremely busy, but by comparison to the way it's been for the last 15 years or so, I felt like I was on vacation. I had time to spend with my wife and my kids, And I had more time to pour into the students of our evangelism boot camp, which was extremely fruitful. I had time to write and read more than usual, to study and catch up on a lot of things that I was behind on. I read a ton of books in 2020. I wrote the equivalent of easily two books in that same time. Of course, I launched this podcast. And as I mentioned, I've been working on several more that will launch this year. And our whole team worked on a bunch of things behind the scenes that you'll be seeing and hearing about this year. In fact, some of you may know that at the stroke of midnight on New Year's, I announced that something great is coming. And then on January 29th, during the evening service of our fire conference, I made the announcement that we're going to be launching a brand new church here in Central Florida called Nations Church. And so if you go to the website, which is wearenations.church, again, that's not .org or .com, that's .church, wearenations.church, you can watch the video of the live announcement. It was pretty epic. And you can even sign up there if you want for one of our interest parties to find out more information about the church, or even just to go ahead and join the launch team. And we also just started the second class of our evangelism boot camp, and we're getting ready to launch a school of worship and other things as well. So again, a lot of great things are in the pipeline. The bottom line is I'm thankful for God's grace and mercy in 2020, and I'm full of faith and optimism about 2021. And let me just remind you of Paul's words in Romans 8:28. I know you know them, but sometimes we need to be reminded anyway that all things work together for the good of them that love God and to them who are called according to his purpose. But, you know, I also realize that there are some of you that have suffered great loss in 2020. Maybe you lost a loved one, or maybe you went through some major personal or health crisis or family crisis. Some wounds are not superficial. People can never be replaced. And there are some things that can never be replaced either. And if that's the kind of pain that 2020 brought you, I pray that the Holy Spirit himself would comfort you and that you would be surrounded with a peace that passes understanding, that will act as a guard for your heart and your mind in Jesus Christ. And while we're on the subject of things that can never be replaced, let me mention another one, a good name. Proverbs 22:1 says that a good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. And several high-profile evangelical leaders lost their good names in 2020. And if you followed me for any length of time, you know that I really hate to mention people by name in a negative context, and I very, very rarely do so. But these scandals were so public that it seems like everyone, even in the secular world, is already aware. So there's not really any point trying to handle it with sensitivity or discretion. The cat is out of the bag, and we might as well just talk about it. And of course, those three most public scandals involved Carl Lentz, the former pastor of Hillsong Church in New York, Ravi Zacharias, the well-known apologist, and Jerry Falwell Jr., who was the president of Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. And the organizations associated with all three of these guys have acknowledged the scandals. That is to say, none of this is hearsay or gossip, and that these organizations are doing the best they can under the circumstances. And what they don't need right now is a bunch of Pharisaical, holier-than-thou, finger-pointing, gloating, and schadenfreude. What they need is our prayer and grace and mercy that triumphs over judgment. But I also think that it behooves us to learn some lessons from these situations. And as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10:12, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. Because if you think that you're wiser and holier and less susceptible to temptation than Ravi Zacharias and Carl Lentz and Jerry Falwell Jr., think again. Even greater men than them have been brought low, and even the best of us only stand by the grace of God. But we can learn from their mistakes, and we can allow the fear of God to sober us again, and we can let the tragedies that those men have just recently experienced serve as a warning for us to stay the course. And maybe in this, there might be some redemption of otherwise unmitigated catastrophes. Now, I'm not going to take the time to address each of the public statements made by these respective organizations, but I want to read one. This one was released by the Executive Committee of the Board of Directors for Ravi Zacharias' ministry, RZIM. It was published on December 23rd, 2020, under the title, quote, Intermediate Response, Allegations Against Ravi Zacharias, end quote. And as of this recording, this is still the most recent official statement. It says this, quote, sadly, the interim investigation update indicates this assessment of Ravi's behavior to be true, that he did indeed engage in sexual misconduct. This misconduct is deeply troubling and wholly inconsistent with the man Ravi Zacharias presented both publicly and privately to so many over more than four decades of public ministry. We are heartbroken at learning this, but feel it necessary to be transparent and to inform our staff, donors, and supporters at this time, even while the investigation continues. We will speak more comprehensively to all concerned after the completion of the investigation. We are devastated for those who have suffered from Ravi's misconduct and for the pain they are enduring. They have asked for confidentiality and anonymity, and both we and the investigators are committed to honoring their wishes. This preliminary statement is not intended to cut short the investigation or predict its full outcome. We want to ensure the investigators have appropriate time and space to complete their work and allow all those who may still desire to have a voice in this process to do so. We ask for continued patience as we complete a lengthy process of investigating serious allegations, end quote. I wanted you to hear some of the loaded sentiment in that statement because it's very clear that people have been deeply hurt by this. People that knew Ravi for decades are saying, this is not the person that we thought we knew. And of course, Ravi's gone now, but they are still having to clean up a mess. And whereas the name of Ravi Zacharias might have gone down in history as one of the great apologists that ever lived, it's possible that now the name will only be a liability. And that's not to say that all of the good things Ravi and his organization did are now discredited, but it will almost certainly detract in some way from Ravi's life work, and I'm sure that it's going to create significant problems for the people that are trying to carry on after his death. And so, again, it behooves us to take this opportunity to carefully consider the consequences of sin and compromise. And, you know, I've had the privilege of speaking into the lives of many leaders, many of whom we've trained and launched into ministry in various ways over the years. And there's probably a good number of you listening to this podcast right now. And I want to admonish you and myself, let's guard our hearts and let's commit ourselves to lives of integrity as never before. So here's what I want to do. I want to give you four reasons that, in my estimation, leaders fall. And then I want to give you four ways to guard yourself and live a life worthy of the call. Now, these points are not intended to be a commentary of any sort on the men that I mentioned specifically earlier. Yes, it's possible that they dealt with some of these things, and it's also possible that their issues were something else. There are also certainly many other things that could be said about this. For example, one of the big issues for high-profile leaders is just a simple lack of accountability. Often, they become so influential and so powerful within their own sphere of influence that there's nobody willing to challenge them. And in many cases, there's nobody that they're associating with that they are actually submitted to. But of course, most of you listening to this are not high-profile preachers, so I'm not going to focus on things that would apply only to a very small minority. Instead, the following points are issues that everyone needs to be aware of. Okay, here we go. Reason number one, they become complacent. You know, I started preaching when I was 14 years old, and I've been involved with some kind of ministry and some kind of leadership ever since. And I can't say that I did everything right, far from it, but one thing that I can say is that I took the responsibility of leading people, even in the smallest ways, very seriously. I still do, by the way, but I'm trying to illustrate something for the sake of this discussion. Even as a teenager, I remember being conscious of the ways that my influence was affecting my peers in school, in youth group, and so on. And there were a lot of things that I wanted to do as a teenager that I didn't do simply because I didn't want to mislead other people or be a bad influence on them. And then later, when I was entrusted with official positions of leadership, of course, that feeling of responsibility went to a whole new level, not only to be a good example for others, but to do everything with excellence, to study, to pray, to be prepared for every situation. And I didn't have very much skill or experience, but what I lacked in ability, I made up for in hard work and passion. I must have prayed for hours the first time I preached. And in the beginning, I remember that before I would preach for days, my stomach would be in knots. And it wasn't just that I was nervous about speaking. It was a deep concern that I had to rightly represent what I was responsible for as a preacher of the gospel. And I remember how on a day when I was preaching, many hours, sometimes even the whole day, would just be spent praying and preparing to preach. In the beginning, for several years, even as a pastor, I had to work a secular job to support my family, and all the ministry stuff that I did was done in my own time and without compensation. And I can remember praying and saying, Lord, I want to be able to give all my time to prayer and the word and to touching people with the gospel. And I just need a little financial support to be able to do that. I was content to live on virtually nothing, and I considered it a worthwhile sacrifice just to be able to work for the Lord. Fast forward to the present. Today, sometimes I preach multiple times in the same day. I've often preached 14 or 15 times in one week. So, needless to say, I'm not able to pray for hours every time I preach anymore. And that's not really the problem. The problem is this, that if you're not careful, you can let what was sacred and consecrated and guarded become common and routine and taken for granted. And in order to keep that from happening, you have to continually remind yourself that this is sacred, that it's special, that God could have chosen anybody else to do this work, but he chose me. And I don't know why, but man, I want to get it right. I want to be faithful. I want to make the Lord proud. And I think it's really good for us to remind ourselves of where we came from. And if you're one of those that's still at the beginning of your journey, don't forget the way you feel right now. Don't forget that humility and simplicity and purity that's motivating you. And if you ever lose that, fall on your face and cry out to God and say, Lord, don't let my heart go cold. Bring me back to my first love. Paul said in Ephesians 4:1, I urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called. And that's what I'm trying to urge you to today as well. And this is not just about preaching. It's about leadership in general, and not just leadership in ministry, but also in our families, in our marriages, in our jobs, in our responsibilities, wherever we find ourselves. And let me say this, you know, one of the symptoms of complacency is boredom. Remember that old adage that idle hands are the devil's workshop. And that's really true, especially for some people. And this is kind of a side note, but often leaders, especially those that tend to be very high octane, high energy, A-type personalities, if they allow themselves to slip into a complacent mode, they're in serious danger because they will quickly get bored and they'll quickly start gravitating to other things to keep them stimulated. And this is a much bigger deal than you might think. I could say a lot about this, but for those of you that are wired this way, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You've got to stay in the battle or you're going to start looking for other conquests, which is exactly, in my opinion, what happened to King David. Remember, he was supposed to be out fighting in battle, and instead he was chilling at home, hanging out And that's how he ended up getting into trouble with Bathsheba. But you know, there's also danger on the opposite side of boredom, which leads me to the second reason that leaders fall. Number two, they burn out. Now, I don't know if you've ever felt really exhausted. I'm not talking about feeling tired. Tired is how you feel after a good day of hard work. It's good for you. It helps you sleep at night. I'm talking about the feeling when you've been grinding for weeks on end with very little rest. Sometimes after a crusade in the past, like I mentioned before, I've had weeks where I preached 15 or 16 times in a 5 or 6 day period. And you got to understand, some of those were 3 hours of preaching and ministry at a time. And then getting on an airplane and flying to one country and another, and then doing it again in another time zone, another hotel. And on some trips, I've had literally 2 or even 3 hotel rooms at the same time in different cities, or in the case of Europe, even in different countries, because I'm bouncing around back and forth between cities with such speed. And I've had extended stints of 2 or 3 months of this kind of sustained intensity, never being in a time zone long enough to adjust, never sleeping more than 2 or 3 hours at a time, spending as much time on airplanes as I'm spending on the ground, never having a moment to myself, always being with other people who are taking you from meeting to meeting and venue to venue. And, you know, even as I'm saying this, I'm aware of how utterly unhealthy this is. But I'm being honest. There are times after landing back in Orlando where I live and getting in the car, driving from the airport to home, I just feel like I'm collapsing on the inside. I think somehow after being propped up by adrenaline and caffeine for a few weeks, somehow when the brain senses that you're getting close to your own bed, it just starts shutting down, sometimes on the road. And I suddenly feel the exhaustion like a wave roll over me. And I feel like I've been hit by a train, and I feel totally sapped of energy. It's an almost desperate feeling. And when that happens, you'll have very little fight left in you. It's probably similar to being drunk or something, because inhibition is very low and you're very vulnerable to temptation in many ways. If you're on a diet, forget it. You'll be pulling into the McDonald's drive-thru because, you know, for me, carbs and sugar is my weakness. But if you have other proclivities, your ability to resist will be very low. And I'm not saying that you can't resist temptation in that state. You can and you must. But I'm also being real with you. If you run yourself into the ground like that, you are going to have problems of one kind or another in time. And, you know, I'm saying this as somebody who used to think that burnout was a fictitious condition that only wimpy people used to justify being lazy. And then one day I had this experience where I had this friend who was one of the hardest working guys I knew, an amazing, godly man, who suddenly fell off the grid, and I heard that he had burnout. And again, I thought it was just an excuse. But then I saw him, and honestly, it was terrifying. He looked like a cancer patient in the last stages, emaciated, his hands literally shaking. He was a shadow of the man I knew, and I realized, this is no joke. And that's obviously an extreme example, but I mention these things because I think that some people, especially young ministers and leaders, tend to think that they can cheat physics and their own biology. And by the time they realize that they're not immortal, it's too late. They have crashed and fallen, and they've done something that can never be undone. And I think that this is partly what the Bible means when it says, "Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." It means that you need to be realistic about your human limitations, and you need to evaluate yourself with sobriety and humility, realizing that you're not Superman and you're not Superwoman, and what you sow is what you will reap. Now, I've talked about a couple of opposite extremes here. One is leaders slipping into complacency and boredom. That's never really been a problem for me, although for others, I know it has been. I tend to err on the other side of being too busy, which is just as dangerous, maybe even more so. But both of these extremes are dangerous because they lead us to the next reason leaders fall. Number three, they lose their enjoyment of God and ministry. And when you've lost your enjoyment of God, that is a very important sign. It means that something critical is happening in your spiritual life. And you need to pay attention to it. It's like the warning light on the dashboard of your car. It's screaming out to you that something bad is happening. And if you neglect it, you're going to pay dearly down the road. You know how I've learned to diagnose my own spiritual health? I analyze one thing, my desire. I know that wherever my desire is pointing, that is the direction that I'm moving in. And I've often told people that when you most need to pray is when you don't feel like praying. And when you least need to pray is when you actually want to. Because you see, if your desire is moving away from God, that means you are moving away from God. And this is a problem for a couple of reasons. First, when you're moving away from someone or something, in this case, God, every day you will find yourself a little bit further away. And these small steps in the wrong direction add up over time. And one day you'll wake up and you won't even know where you are and how you got there. And you'll look around and you won't see God anywhere. And you'll say, how did this happen? Well, it happened one step at a time, one day at a time, where your desire was moving you in the wrong direction. And the second reason that losing your enjoyment of God is a huge problem is that when you lack that enjoyment, you're going to start looking for other sources of joy outside of God. Leonard Ravenhill used to say, entertainment is the devil's substitute for joy. And this is when people start turning to alcohol and drugs and porn, and they start flirting with lust and adultery and all kinds of sin. And here's the problem. These steps that I'm describing to you have this kind of snowball effect. They catalyze one another. When you start losing your enjoyment of God and you stop spending time with Him and you start sinning to fill the void, then you feel guilty about the sin and you start avoiding prayer. And because of that, then you feel even further from God. So you start sinning more, which makes you feel even less like praying and so on. And so it just is this negative feedback loop. And this leads to the fifth point, which is the death knell. Number four, they lose their fear of God. Now, I won't say too much about this one, but when a person hardens their heart over and over again through the process that I'm describing, that hardening begins to manifest in that they lose their fear of God. And this means that sin stops bothering them. Prayerlessness stops bothering them. They have learned to resist the conviction of the Holy Spirit so much that they don't even notice it anymore. And this is where things get really, really dangerous. And to be honest, you know, we're talking about how great leaders fall, but honestly, I think that in many cases, their fall comes not only as an inevitable consequence of the path they're on, but also as a sort of divine, merciful intervention. Because, you know, some people need to hit rock bottom before they are going to look up. And maybe God allows some of these guys to fall just so that they're able to realize how far they've already fallen. I think something like that happened to David when he had that famous moral failure that I mentioned earlier. And I think the same thing happens today as well. We even see in 1 Corinthians 5, Paul instructs the Corinthians regarding a man that's sleeping with his mother-in-law. He says, hand him over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh so that his spirit might be saved. In other words, Paul apparently feels that this guy is so far gone that it's going to have to take some rock bottom experience to bring him back to repentance. But Paul feels that it's better than the alternative. So how do you counteract this process? How do you keep from becoming another casualty or statistic? Maybe even as I was going through that four-step process, you recognized one of those steps yourself. And maybe you haven't fallen yet, but maybe you're on the second or the third step. Maybe you've already become complacent and started to lower your guard and compromise. Maybe you've already started to feel that loss of enjoyment of God and of ministry. Well, if you're wise, you'll recognize what's happening. And maybe there's still time to make a change before it's too late. Or maybe you haven't gone down this road at all yet and you're doing good. But still, if you're wise, you'll take heed lest you fall too, because you are also a human made of flesh and blood, and life has a way of throwing curveballs. And if you're not prepared to do what's necessary to guard yourself, then at some point in your life, you'll make an easy target for the enemy. So just like I gave you four reasons that leaders fall, let me give you four ways to protect yourself. And these are highly personal things I'm going to tell you now. This is not just some random list to fill space and take time. Each one of these things are things that I've lived and continue to need to remember on a daily basis. Number one, kill your pet dragon. In my book on spiritual warfare called Slaying Dragons, I have a chapter called How to Kill Your Pet Dragon. And the title of this chapter is a bit of a playful nod to an animated children's movie called How to Train Your Pet Dragon. And it occurred to me one day that the dragons we find ourselves battling in life are often the monsters we ourselves have incubated and nurtured and even trained until they threaten to, and in some cases actually do, destroy people's lives. I came across this article in the National Geographic one time with a headline that said, quote, "Why an 8-foot pet python may have killed its owner," end quote. And it talked about a man in England who was killed by his yellow African rock python, ironically named Tiny. And I thought, what an appropriate illustration of the way that sin destroys so many people's lives. It starts out as something small and innocent, even cute, and they think it's no big deal. It's something that they think they can control until they can't. And by the time they come to terms with the fact that they have a problem, it's already grown into a serious monster that has the potential to destroy their family and their life and their legacy and everything they've spent their whole lives cultivating. And in that How to Kill Your Pet Dragon chapter, I gave an example from my own life, an example that probably seems silly to most people, but I wanted to make this really practical. Let me just read that excerpt for you. It says, quote, "I've always hated haircuts. Whenever I have to get one, I just want it over with. I don't like the itchy hairs that fall into my shirt. I'm an introvert by nature, which means I don't like having to make small talk for 40 minutes. Nothing about getting a haircut is pleasant to me. But years ago, I started going to a salon where things changed. In this particular salon, the lady that I was assigned to was very attractive. She was interesting to talk to and seemed very interested in me. When she cut my hair, the time flew by. I went to that salon for about 2 months and enjoyed my interaction with this young lady each time. One day I woke up and saw that I had a haircut scheduled for the day. I felt a little flutter of excitement inside. It surprised me. I'd always hated getting a haircut, but now I was looking forward to it. Why? Obviously, I was excited at the thought of seeing that attractive young woman. Now, I should mention that I was married at the time with 2 or 3 children already. The fact that I was looking forward to spending time with another woman alarmed me. I realized what was happening. Something was growing. It was still very innocent, but if I continued down that road, I shuddered at the thought of what it might become. I called the salon, canceled my appointment, and never went back. Most likely, that situation would never have developed into anything serious. I'm fully aware of that. I'm also aware that every affair could be traced back to a little innocent flutter of excitement. So many disasters could have been avoided painlessly if someone had just dealt with little temptations ruthlessly. Now, I'm sure that many people might see this as a ridiculous overreaction, but remember how Jesus told us to deal with temptation. If your hand offends you, cut it off. If your eye offends you, gouge it out, Matthew 5:29-30. I was honest with myself. I know that I'm not invincible. I recognized the latent potential for a little dragon egg to begin growing in my life, and I dealt with it quickly and thoroughly. If you think you are beyond such temptation, remember that greater men and women than you and I have been destroyed by sin. 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, "Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." Those who think too highly of themselves and their immunity to temptation are setting themselves up for failure. This is why Paul said, "Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith God has distributed to each of you." Romans 12:3, end quote. So that's number one, kill your pet dragon. Number two, mind in the beginning what matters in the end. Now, the last chapter of my book, Live Before You Die, contains some of the things that I'm going to mention now. For example, I told a story there that Reinhard Bonnke told me. He said that as a young man, he was kneeling at the altar during a prayer meeting next to an elderly pastor, and he overheard that old man weeping as he was praying, and he was asking God to forgive him for unclean things that he had allowed into his life. And Reinhard said that as he overheard this, it shook him. He got up and he went to the other side of the room to another spot where no one could hear, and he cried out to God with a prayer of his own, and he said, "Lord, help me to mind in the beginning what matters in the end." And I can truly say that Reinhard lived that way. He lived with the end in mind. And I believe that one of the reasons that he was able to go through his entire life in ministry without a single scandal is because of that perspective. And you know, I started out by mentioning that there are some things that can never be recovered. Among them is a good name. But Reinhard Bonnke's name not only remained a good name through his life, it's such a good name that it continues to lend credibility and favor to the ministry that he founded, Christ for All Nations, and to the people that are connected with him, like me. Even today, I often hear people on television interviews and in pulpits talking about how they knew Reinhard and saying that they were mentored by him, etc. And in fact, I know of people that claim Reinhard Bonnke mentored them, and they only ever had lunch with him one time. Some of them, I'm certain Reinhard wouldn't have even remembered meeting them. But they love to attach their name to his. Why? Because it's a good name. But you know, it works the opposite way too. I have a friend that worked closely with a very well-known preacher who had a very public fall. And my friend, even though he did absolutely nothing wrong, has been tainted by that preacher's bad reputation and has spent years trying to salvage his own reputation. Now, this is not all about names and reputations here. I don't want you to get that impression. That's not the main point. Staying true and being faithful is not about just earning some positive eulogies at your funeral. Fundamentally, it's about walking in a manner worthy of the calling, as I mentioned earlier. It's about living with the judgment seat of Christ in mind. And it's about knowing that one day we're going to stand before God and we're going to give an account for the things that we did in our bodies, according to 2 Corinthians 5:10. It's about living with the end in mind. And that reminds me of something else that I wrote about in the last chapter of Live Before You Die. Let me just read what I wrote there. It says, quote, "I'll never forget a sermon that I heard when I was in seminary from our college president, Michael L. Brown, PhD. He preached about a fascinating word that appears in the Hebrew scriptures 61 times. It is acharit. There is really no single word equivalent for it in English, but the literal meaning of it is the final or ultimate end. It speaks of the backside or hinder parts, the part that is to follow, the part that is to come, the final end. We find this word in Psalms 37, 37 through 38. Mark the perfect man and behold the upright, for the end, acharit, of that man is peace. But the transgressors shall be destroyed together. The end, acharit, of the wicked shall be cut off." The German monk, Thomas A. Kempis, is well known to have said, "Happy is the man who hath the hour of his death always before his eyes." But if he would have been Hebrew, he probably would have said it this way: "Happy is the man who hath the hour of his acharit, his final end, before his eyes." This would have been a better quote anyway, since there is a final end beyond the hour of our death and beyond the grave. Now, I read that excerpt from the statement from RZIM's executive committee of the board of directors, where it talked about how grieved they were at the discoveries of misconduct and how it was wholly inconsistent with the man that they thought they knew, and so on. But let me read another statement to you that I think is a bit easier to reflect on dispassionately, because this isn't front page news anymore. This is from quite a few years ago. And you probably won't even know who made the statement, although you'd probably know his name if I told you. But that's not really the point. All you need to know is this. The statement that I'm going to read now is from a man who was nationally known a few years ago, a very, very high profile and very influential leader in the body of Christ. And he had a very public fall when he was also found guilty of sexual misconduct and exposed in the mainstream news. It was a huge shock at the time. And it's hard to imagine what it was like being part of his congregation, seeing the news on TV, and then sitting there in utter disbelief as he delivered his apology on Sunday morning. And I read the transcript of this years ago, and I saved it because it had such an impact on me. This is just one paragraph. He said, quote, "I am so sorry. I'm sorry for the disappointment, the betrayal, and the hurt. I'm sorry for the horrible example I've set for you. I have an overwhelming, all-consuming sadness in my heart for the pain that you and I and my family have experienced over the past few days. I'm so sorry for the circumstances that have caused shame and embarrassment to all of you," end quote. Now, why do I mention this? Because I want you to do a little thought experiment with me. Imagine if this minister 20 or 30 years ago, at the very beginning, when he first started flirting with the sin that eventually destroyed him, imagine if he could have gotten into a time machine and gone into the future and sat there in that service and listened to himself deliver that speech on that Sunday morning. Imagine what he would have thought and felt as he heard his future self on that fateful Sunday morning telling his tearful congregation, "I am a liar and a deceiver." Imagine if he could have seen the pain and the heartache that would grow from those small early compromises. What if he could have seen the tears in his wife's and children's eyes? If he could have seen the end from the beginning, I think a righteous anger would have arisen in his soul. And I think he probably would have dealt with those issues quickly and decisively. And so now let me ask you, what are you flirting with right now that 5 or 10 or 15 years from now is going to be a monster threatening to destroy your life, your marriage, and your ministry? So, number one, kill your pet dragon. Number two, mind in the beginning what matters in the end. Number three, feed the good stuff. I remember several years ago, I got into this phase where I was really diving deep into apologetics. And one of the subjects I was studying was the problem of suffering. And as you might know, this is one of the most difficult philosophical and theological questions that apologists face. Because it's not just about human suffering, which is easily explained as a result of sin. It includes non-human animal suffering as well, and lots of questions that are really not easy to answer theologically. So I was reading different books on the subject, and I came to one in particular. I think it was called Nature Red in Tooth and Claw, if I remember right. This is quite a few years ago now, but the book was written in such a way that it was actually doing a better job of presenting the problems than it was at offering any solutions. In other words, the more I read, the more skeptical I was feeling. And I didn't like this, but I thought, well, there must be light coming at the end of the tunnel somewhere. And I was about 2/3 of the way through the book when I fell asleep while reading it. And I was suddenly jolted awake by the voice of God shouting in my heart. Now, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but sometimes the Lord speaks to me in this state where I'm just in between asleep and awake. And when that happens, it's very vivid and very clear and almost audible. Anyway, I'll never forget what I heard the Lord say that day. I can quote it to you. He said, quote, "Feed your faith and build your prayer life," end quote. And I knew immediately what that meant. It was a sort of rebuke, as if the Lord was saying to me, stop feeding the skepticism and the cynicism and the unbelief and start feeding your faith. He also said, build your prayer life, which is an interesting thing to say that I'll have to elaborate on another time. But suffice it to say, I think one of the keys to going the distance is to feed the good stuff in our lives, the things that we want to grow, things that we want to develop. And it might sound somewhat cliche, but it's so true. Whatever you feed in your life grows, and whatever you starve dies. There's a lot more I could say about that, but let's move on to the final point. Number four, stay satisfied. You know, the ultimate defense against temptation is satisfaction. Because temptation works through our lusts, according to James. And lusts are distorted expressions of God-given desires. For example, sexual desire, which is often what people think of when they hear the word lust, is God-given. Yes, God invented sex, if you didn't know. God made men and women for each other. The perpetuation of the human race depends upon it. So, yeah, it's good. It's wonderful. It's a God-given thing. But lust happens when that desire is misdirected. Then it becomes something sinful and dangerous. Allow me to read once more from my book, Slaying Dragons, where I address this very issue. It says, quote, "Have you ever noticed that things taste so much better when you're hungry? But after you've eaten and you're full, you could walk right past a buffet of delicious delicacies and not have the slightest desire for them." Proverbs 27:7 says it this way, "A satisfied soul loathes the honeycomb, but to a hungry soul, every bitter thing is sweet." Perhaps you've heard the cliche that we were created with a God-shaped hole inside of us that only He can fill. Augustine said it this way, "Thou hast made us for Thyself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in Thee." But if that hunger is not satisfied with God, then even the bitter taste of sin becomes appetizing. If a person strives to be holy by desperately trying to avoid the buffet of worldly indulgences without having satisfied his soul in God, that person will remain hungry, and the temptation to sin will become greater and gain more and more power over him. But when you get full of God, sin will lose its appeal. If you become satisfied by the ultimate delight of God's presence, you will not want to waste your time with anything less. End quote. And so the question is, how do you cultivate this satisfaction with God? And the answer is simple, by spending time with Him and by learning to enjoy Him. This is one of the keys to the Christian life. And as a side note, you know, if this is something that intrigues you, or maybe you don't really understand what I mean, or you don't know how, in a practical sense, to experience God and to enjoy Him and have fellowship with Him, I actually have created a whole series on YouTube about this very thing. I recorded it with some of my dear friends, and it's really rich. There's more than 30 videos there. They're relatively short and all obviously free. And they answer questions like, why don't I feel God's presence when I pray? And what prevents people from experiencing God in prayer? And how to overcome distractions in prayer? How to keep your mind from wandering? What to do when you don't feel like praying? How to deal with doubt and fear and guilt in prayer? How to pray when your heart is broken? What to do when you don't feel a desire for God? There's practical tips there about how long and when and where and how often you should pray and how to stay awake and so on. And we talk in that series about hearing God's voice, the role of fasting and intercession and worship and petition and meditation and so many other things. And you can find that by going to my YouTube channel. Just search for Daniel Kalenda and go to the playlists. And one of those playlists is called Experiencing God. And this is especially important in seasons like we're in now, when people are bored and looking for entertainment. We need to make sure that our hearts are staying focused on Him and full of Him more than ever before. And so let me just tell you, I'll put in the description the link to that playlist in YouTube. I will put a link there to my book, Slaying Dragons and Live Before You Die. And all the things that I've been talking about today, you can find right there in the description. And with that, let me just say, thank you for listening. I hope these next few months are filled with fruitfulness and blessing, even in the midst of whatever trials and fire awaits us. And let me remind you one more time that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them that are called according to His purpose. That means you. Blessings. Now, don't forget, if you have any questions that you'd like me to address on this program, or if you just want to get in touch with us, you can send those questions to questions@askdk.com. The DK stands for Daniel Kalenda, just in case you didn't make that connection. Again, that's questions@askdk.com. Also, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. If you're watching on social media, be sure to like the page or subscribe to the channel. I've got so much amazing content on deck for you coming through the rest of the year. You don't want to miss a single episode of Daniel Kalenda Off the Record.